Hey everybody, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired. I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach. Today we're talking about the roll of the dice and the value of chance and choice in student projects and assessments and in our classrooms for any age, whether it's littles, middles, high schools, all the way up to adult learners. We'll get to that in a second, but before we get to it, some housekeeping notes. Each week the podcast hits on Mondays. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. If you do like what you're hearing, it's the start of a conversation. It's not meant to be a one-way piece of just, you know, like word dump. So I would love to dialogue with you. Feel free to message me back. I can be on Twitter, at Meehan, E-D-U. That's Meehan like my last name, and E-D-U like teaching, because I like teaching. Or you can find me on the internet. I'm at www.adrenalinerush.com. That's adrenaline with an E, like educational adrenaline, which is also the name of my book, Adrenaline Rush, all about game-changing student engagement, inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. So hit me up, let's talk, and let's keep conversation going about the role of the dice and chance and choice and how we can use these things in our classrooms to make a more engaged classroom for all of our learners. And I want to start with a bit of a metaphor. Have you ever been to a restaurant? Let's say the Cheesecake Factory. Cheesecake Factory is a really good example of a restaurant that is like a complete corporate chain America with all different styles of food available to it. You walk in the front doors and the architecture is kind of all over the map. It kind of looks like a Roman Colosseum, but also part of a mall. I'm not entirely clear on that. And you get the menu, and it's probably, if your Cheesecake Factory is anything like mine, it's like a dozen pages or more. The cheesecakes alone will take up 4 or 5 pages in there, but there's a lot of food available at the Cheesecake Factory. A lot of different, you know, cuisines from regions, you know, so you have these Mediterranean foods, you have like these, you know, American foods like burgers and things like that. But then they have sometimes like these Asian-inspired flair with like, you know, Asian-inspired fare with, you know, maybe it's some sort of fusion cuisine, or there's vegan cuisine, vegetarian stuff, and you know, plus fish dishes, because why not? You know, that's a high-ticket item that you can make in any restaurant. And very quickly, if you're like me, you kind of look to the menu and look through the menu, and you start to do that thing where your eyes glaze over. More than that, you're like, well, I don't know. I mean, this place isn't really known for this or that. It's called the Cheesecake Factory, not the Fish Factory, right? So you're really just trying to save up room for that main course, which is the dessert. And you start to just, I don't know, just pick one of these things. I don't really care what it is. You kind of do it. Then they deliver the food, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes later, after your appetizers, and it's good. I mean, like, it's not bad food. It's not actively bad. I joke, and I apologize if you're a fan of it. Red Robin is actively bad. I don't like that restaurant. I just don't know why. I think, like, on the pantheon of things, like, Red Robin's at the bottom. Then up from there, you have, like, TGI Fridays and Ruby Tuesdays neck and neck, and maybe Chili's just north of that. But I think, like, Cheesecake Factory is probably in the Fridays, Ruby Tuesdays, Chili's kind of area. I don't think it's like a Red Robin type. I don't know. If you love Red Robin, God bless you. It's not my scene. But I order food at a Cheesecake Factory, and I invariably get it and think, it was okay. But it wasn't like the best food I ever had. Like, it's like hotel food, but like, I don't know, with a little bit more seasoning. Like, it's not aggressively offensive. I'm not sitting here saying, oh, I'm done with it. I'll never eat at this place again. I'm going to throw it across the table. And it's not that the service is lousy or the you know, the place is unclean, anything like that. It's just like it's kind of mediocre. It's maybe north of mediocre. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's a solid 7. Cheesecake Factory is one of those places you go when you have like 10 people in a party who all like want to get together either after a big old thing or before a big old thing. And you're like, yeah, well, there's no restaurants in the area, but there's a Cheesecake Factory attached to the mall. And that's fine because, I don't know, you spend, what, $30 an entree or something like that. It's not the fanciest dinner you've ever had, but it's an above, you know, Chick-fil-A, above McDonald's kind of night, above Chipotle. But I want to think about the other side of things. I think about like the nicest dinners I've ever had. Been to, you know, nice restaurants, really nice restaurants. Not often, but you know, a few times in my life. And even Chipotle is a good example of it. When I go to a place that's a really nice restaurant, the nicest of nice restaurants I've ever been to, like one of those, you know, celebrity chef ones, like Eric Repair or you know, Emeril Lagasse or Gordon Ramsay. I realize some of these guys have chain restaurants too, so you do have to be careful. But like, when you go to their nicest of nice restaurants, or you go to their, you know, really, you know, high-end ones that are very shishi, la-di-da, attached to like a nice resort, They'll typically offer a tasting menu from the chef. And what it is for the party is you pay a flat rate, you know, a fixed price. I can never say that in French, but prix fixe, I don't know. And you pay that one rate, and then you just sort of like take a breath, and there's like five courses that they bring out to you, one after another after another. And they're usually very small plates, but they're all picked by the chef. And there's like a rotating menu, so it changes all the time. And you just kind of like, you don't know what you're going to get. You have to tell them in the beginning if you have any allergies. Like, oh yeah, I have a shellfish allergy, or, you know, I can't do gluten. But once you tell them that, you just got to take a breath and you wait. And what I found at these restaurants, and again, there's an illusion of quality because you're paying more money for it too, but I've never been disappointed at these restaurants. And I consider myself more of a picky than not eater, or picky eater than not. What I think about all this stuff, so how does that matter and how does that contextualize? I think there's a certain amount of analysis paralysis, how's that for a rhyme, that occurs when we as patrons or as you know, visitors or as guests walk in and see that there's almost limitless choice. You know, at the Cheesecake Factory, if you ordered one entree, there's probably like 75 other entrees that you didn't order. Where if you go to a tasting menu, or even like Chipotle, there's like one thing on the menu, and you just figure out how to dress up that one thing, but it's only one thing. And I think Chipotle is a really good example of it too, because when they opened, you know, originally, they had burritos. That was it. And I think you can get like a burrito bowl. Then later they had like soft shell tacos, but it really was just the same thing, just prepared slightly differently. And then I get a little bit fancy when they were like, oh, you can add some cheese and we'll make some, you know, quesadillas or something like that. But Chipotle pretty much just makes like one or two things. And you walk down the line, the assembly line, you say, okay, what do you want on your burrito? But there's only three types of salsa and there's only four types of meat. And that's it. That's the day at Chipotle. And so because you've kind of run the numbers in your head, for every choice you've made, you've unmade three or four other choices. But what winds up happening with Chipotle is you walk away saying, oh, that's my burrito. That was really good. And you know, personally, that you prefer chicken to beef or something like that, or you prefer the carnitas. So you don't walk away saying, ah, but I wonder if I would have done that other thing. Because there was a limited number of choices, and so it kind of alleviated some of that analysis paralysis, right? If you go to a chef's tasting, sure, you're paying a lot of money for the place, so you want it to be really swanky and very high-end. But the truth is, like, I don't know, the decision-making is done for you. You went in and said, I trust the chef, who's a professional, to come up with the ideas that make sense for this meal. What pairs together well, what goes together in sequence, you know, what would be the right combinations of flavors and things like that. And I think sometimes when I start to go to restaurants and I do that picky thing where I'm like, okay, I want the chicken, but can you hold the X, or can you substitute the Y, or can I bring in a Z instead of a... I think what winds up happening is I walk away saying, that was only ever good, maybe north of good, but maybe not great. So how does this matter in a classroom? We know that student choice and student voice are big drivers in 21st century classrooms. We want to see our students getting really, really good at thinking on their feet and coming up with their own ideas and helping to shape their own educational landscape. So how do we give them choice? Because at a certain point, if we just said, come on into my English class and write an essay about whatever you want to write about, I think at a certain point, that would be the thing that would make a child just like an eyes glaze over, just bug out of the head and say, I don't know what I'm doing. So I wonder if there's a value in limited choice. Specifically with like essays or topics, you know, giving a choice A, a choice B, a choice C, and then maybe if you feel really brave, really, really brave, and again, you got to know your students and know your audience, maybe choice D is, or something else that you think would be a good pick, just let me know. The AP tests have done that sort of thing with the American literature, or I'm sorry, the literature test. They say for the essay part, write an essay about like the value of growing up or the value of Bulding's Roman stories, you know, the coming of age stories. Pick any of these 10 novels listed on the left-hand side or another work of similar literary merit. So if I said on the list of books, we have To Kill a Mockingbird, which is of course a very famous growth narrative. We have The Scarlet Letter, which is about a woman who's coming of age in a Puritan society. She's shunned and forgotten. We have Huckleberry Finn, which is, of course, you know, this great American westward expansion, satire, and growth story. Huck Finn is a really good example of, like, a growth narrative. But maybe as a student, you'd never read those things. So maybe you could have in there another work of literary merit of the same, you know, size and shape. And you said, well, you know what? I read The Hate U Give. And that, to me, is a really powerful novel about growth and maturation. This Bildungsroman story about somebody who's learning about the hard parts of life by growing up very quickly. And of course, it's about, you know, police violence and a shooting. It's a contemporary classic, and it is sort of geared more towards young adults. But you can do the exact same essay where you bring in text evidence about why our hero or our heroine is learning about him or herself, or learning about the world, what they're learning, anchored, of course, in solid text evidence about when X happens, when Y happens, when Z happens, because that's really what the essay is testing you to do. Can you find text evidence from the book that you read in order to make the case why this thing fits the bill? That's it. So I think about that in my own classroom. Ways to introduce choice or limited choice in the classroom so as not to overwhelm our students. And one of the things I found that works really, really well is simply, like, and it's sort of cornball, but like the roll of a dice. Students, if they do not feel comfortable choosing, because there's an analysis paralysis with that too, like, I don't know what I'm doing today. I don't like this one that it's just too much, right? I'll often use a dice in classroom when we're doing either writing or reading or an annotation or a drafting activity where come on up to the front of the class one at a time or team by team, roll a 6-sided dice, roll a 12-sided dice, a 20-sided dice, whatever it is. And based on the fate of what the dice says, that's what's going to give you your prompt for the day. And if you don't like what you rolled, you know, it's a game. You can change it. Maybe you reserve the right to say, hey, if you're not sure, just roll the dice. If you have a really strong preference and you want to overrule the dice, that's your call. You know, as a teacher, you reserve the right to kind of bend the rules as you need. But I've also found that that expedites a lot of processes too, because students will spend a lot of time like in the batter's box just figuring out how to swing the bat before they even step up to the plate. And at a certain point, you need them to kind of take confidence and say, hey, just practice swinging. You know what? Step up. I'm going to throw you a few softballs. Like, I want to see that in my students, that confidence, that just order, trust the chef. Like, it's going to be okay. Don't spend hours just flipping through pages and then saying, you know, what I picked was only okay. I wonder if I could have picked something else. And so the idea of like narrowing and limited choice does help us, because at a certain point, if you have choice for everything, then you really have choice in nothing. And at the same time, if you have students who develop skills or strengths that they're really excited about, what are ways that they can kind of, I guess, activate or accentuate those choices in the classroom to really become more proud of what they're doing and more responsible for it and own it? Sometimes it starts with something as simple as, hey, there's only 3 choices here. The chef is going to give you a food you've never had before. Just try it. I think you might like it. And then when they like it, it's like, oh, cool. You want to do that again? Hey, there's all these different resources that come as related to that. Here's something that you might enjoy more. If you liked X, you really love Y. Or roll that dice, give it a shot. And you know what? If you hate it, we never have to try it again. But it wasn't your fault. It was the fault of the dice. I find that for my students, younger and older, there's an incredible peace that comes with that. You know, the peace that comes with just saying, this wasn't my fault. I'm just doing what I was told to do today. And you know what? It's not so bad. So then moving forward, maybe that dice can lead into bigger choices down the line. And again, all of that stuff really lends itself to ownership and some authorship and some autonomy, which is really great for any classroom. That's it for today. Thanks so much for paying attention. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to subscribe on iTunes or anywhere else. We'll be back next week with more. And thanks again.